Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The following footage proves beyond any doubt that the tanks intentionally set the house on fire. It proves that the Branch Davidians were murdered. You can see that this tank has a gas jet on the front that shoots fire. You can also see the fire quite plainly. The tank goes into the house twice, and each time as it backs out, the fire at the gas jet is plainly visible.
We must all do more to recognize and look for the early warning signals that deeply troubled young people send.
Hey guys, it's Jose Galison. You're watching No Way Jose. You can find us on No Way Jose YouTube channel, all the major auto podcatchers, and Rumble as well. Today my guest is Igor Sarsky. We're going to be covering the smiley face killings today, kind of giving you a little bit of taste, a little intro. I know we've talked about a little bit on my 76409A playlist with all that stuff, and I found this to be particularly interesting, so I wanted to dive into it a little bit more with you guys. I do want to remind you guys how this works. Obviously, you guys may be paying attention, noticing I do my weekly live stream show, Already Dead. That's a live stream, but these, my other No Way Jose episodes, they are still doing I'm doing the paywall thing, releasing them roughly a week or so later. If you have that early access to those episodes and you go to patreon.com, just No Way Jose 2020, the lowest level is $2 just to get the early stuff if you want to get it like a week earlier than everybody else. But otherwise you can just wait. And also I have my highest level is my sponsors. I read them off every episode. I have Toad, who's a co-host of my co-host on Tower Gang. Follow him at Tower Gang Toad. Then I have at Abrogate D's, then Kevin B. Clark, a full-time guitarist and private music teacher in the New York area. Then at @ZOVERACK, then @_infinitezeal, then Jacob Daniel of the Biblical Anarchy podcast at Biblical Anarchy, then Tim Tuttle at Jolly on Klebold. That's where I get a lot of those fire edits. That one's Laney, though, the one you saw today. And then I also have at StinkySock420. He's a singer of the band Bender, which is a metalcore band, which I dig metalcore. And if you do too, go check that out. But with that, let's get our guest in here. Hey, Igor, how you doing? Is it Igor or Igor?
Igor, but I mean, Igor. it's a pseudonym anyways, so
mine's a pseudonym too, so I don't care. You can call me Juase or whatever, although there's not really many different pronunciations of Jose.
Pseudonym sounds a lot better than mine, actually.
I don't know. They have different flavors to them. This is just some like made-up name forever ago in Facebook days when I was getting nuked all the time. And I got tired of arguing with my family, so I was like, I'll just make an alt, and then it's just carried over into my podcast world. And here I am. I just thought it'd be funny to make myself Hispanic for some reason at the time. And here we are. You thought it'd be funny to make yourself Eastern European, I guess. I don't know what the meant.
I am actually Eastern European, so I'm not okay. I'm not going in that direction. Yeah.
Yeah, I always joke them Argentinian, obviously. and then say my grandpa speaks German or something like that. But Igor, this is the first time you've been on the show. So I want to give you the chance to introduce yourself, let people know about you, what you do, kind of what drives you, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. I mean, I, as the title says, I am into the smiley face killings. I've been kind of researching these cases from a private researcher perspective, probably for the better part of 14 years, I would say, on and off some years. But I got into these cases, and we'll go over exactly what these cases constitute for your viewers, but I got into these cases around 2010, when a kid that I knew personally, Matthew Besner, went missing from a restaurant in Old Port, Montreal, and was found 3 days later in the Lachine Canal, which is a waterway, dead, obviously. I was interested in the case because it was completely unresolved. Nobody ever answered the question as to why or how he entered the water. And that there was a lot of media attention at the time in terms of how suspicious it was, yet there was still no resolution to the case. Clearly, with a couple Google clicks here and there, you see that there's been a lot more cases exactly like his all around the Midwest of the United States. And that's kind of where the rabbit hole started for me.
Absolutely. Well, all right. Well, let's start off with, as I said, my audience has only gotten a little bit of a taste. And I think you might be willing to admit the smiley face killings is kind of like niche, even in the parapolitics world. I had never even heard of it until I dug into, I feel like I've heard faint echoes somewhere, but I couldn't ever place it. Like, it seems similar when I heard of the concept of something I've heard of before, but I couldn't place where. After digging into 09A, 764, all that stuff, it kind of came up in that discussion. So I think my audience is probably in a similar place of probably, you know, not having dug into it much. So it might be a good place to start with, what in the hell are the smiley face killings, or what is this concept we're even speaking of? How do we, I guess, kind of like a starting place, like what's a good starting place to kind of introduce people to this concept? What do they need to know, et cetera, like that, those type of things. What are we talking about here?
No problem. The first thing I would say is just divorce yourself completely from the notion of smiley faces in general, or smiley face graffiti. It has nothing to do with these cases. That was a theory that occurred with a couple investigators out of New York, Gannon, Gilbertson, and Duarte, from 1995. They have never come out with any kind of reinforcing evidence for that claim that there's any kind of graffiti attaching or connecting the cases. However, it's stuck. You know how the mind works in the media. It works. It's spread. It's very catchy, smiley face killers. But from a very logical perspective, there's actually a way to kind of map out what exactly the phenomenon constitutes. And it, as I said, it has nothing to do with smiley face killings. So from my perspective...
Real quick, before you go on, do you have some sort of preferred other vernacular for it? Not, but because I get what you mean. It's kind of like what stuck, but it is one of those things that, like, maybe from a researcher's perspective, you could think it may or may not paint it in a negative light, since it's like...
It certainly does. I don't
know, it's kind of like an unfounded theory within this larger, broader thesis, so now it's being attributed to it by its name alone. Do you have like a preferred thing? Because I will say, like, SFK, smiley face killers, killings, it does have the riz, you know.
It does it has, and it also is what people understand, right? So when you say that, they understand what type of cases, the parameters you're talking about. And I'm like, I can explain the parameters, but I don't actually have a different name. Okay. I agree with you, it should be renamed. For just to do it more justice. The name certainly does not do it justice. It in fact, as you pointed out very astutely, it detracts from actually, you know, wise or logical inquiries into the cases, because people think smiley face graffiti, it's very, you know, it doesn't sound very credible. At first glance.
Branding wise, it's on point. Branding wise, that's great. I will say that.
There's a reason why it's stuck, there's no doubt.
Yeah. But all right, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just thought that was an interesting point.
No, that is.
Like, I didn't know if there was something that researchers were using otherwise that was a little bit more accurate or something. This is just the only vernacular I've really seen, and it does stick. And then as you, I don't know if you saw the thumbnail I used for this. It just, you know, the Watchmen like smiley face. It just is, it has like the branding inbuilt. It's hard. I don't know if you'll ever be able to get away from this name, but yeah, I guess in an accurate sense, it would probably be better to have a different name. Even if there is merit to the smiley face things, just because it's one smaller thesis within the larger one that hasn't really been proven out is what it sounds like to me. So, yeah.
Well, it's not that it hasn't been proven. It's that the original researchers were focusing on a very small subset of cases. Mm-hmm. And there's not only a larger amount of cases that happened in that time frame that they didn't address, but there's also, since their theory came out, been innumerable amounts of cases, which means they haven't released anything to substantiate it. So as of this point, there's no reason to think that there is any connectable aspect in terms of graffiti. It's nice to think of delusions of grandeur that they might come out with some type of trump card and prove everybody wrong, but it's been 25 years since they released since their original investigation started, and I believe since they released their first book. So I, you know, 25 years is a long time.
Yeah.
Let's get into it though. So we can ensure your viewers are just, you know, fully knowledgeable on what the parameters are of this phenomenon. From my perspective, it's typified by a young man who leaves a bar, party, or event alone at an odd hour of the night, only to vanish without a trace. So sometimes the victim is later found dead in water. I would say most times, probably 85% of the caseload, whereas the other 15%, the victim is never found. Essentially, the hallmark of the phenomenon, where you know that it is somehow within the phenomenon or within the parameters, is that the victim must disappear without a trace after engaging in some sort of nightlife or some manner of nightlife, right? Which is kind of how I would kind of peg the phenomenon in terms of, so your viewers would understand fully.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm kind of curious. You brought up the MO. I did. One thing I noticed is there seems to be an archetype of an individual that seems to be usually picked. It seems to be the through line I've caught on to here. Maybe I'm wrong. It seems to be this general archetype of, I don't know whether you want to call him the jock, the scholar, some combo, the archetypical good guy or good girl, because I believe there have been cases with women, but it generally seems to be a guy that's, you know, at a spot in his life to where, like, whether it be college or early, you know, young adulthood, and, you know, generally it seems to be people, whether they be jock, someone with good grades, whatever, someone with a bright outlook, is it seems to be the kind of people they target. You know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Like, does that seem to be, what is the typical target here that we're looking at, the type of people that they get?
You're definitely right. And that kind of drove the theories of foul play the hardest for the last 20 years, was the fact that the victims themselves were pigeonholed so tightly into one particular demographic, which is, you know, medium to slim build white kid, you know, college age, or a little bit older, you know, 25, 24. And it was always the same, as you said, and it was very, very strange. Now, in the last 3 or 4 years, it's strange. There's been a lot of African-American cases, whereas before it was almost unheard of to even have a single one. For 20 years, the demographic was pigeonholed. I don't know why the demographic is expanding. I think I've already kind of theorized to you is that, yeah, the MO is just getting out, right? It's just disseminating more and more over time. More and more people are hearing about it, and as such, more and more people are using it, and that means the demographic of victims will expand, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think that's kind of why I loosely use the demographic of, like, kind of the stereotypical good kid, I guess you could say, because I think as we get into more modern times, that demographic will shift, because obviously 20, 30 years ago, the archetype of that would fit that mold would typically probably be male, early 20s, white, you know, middle class, you know, someone who's, you know, maybe the first guy to go to college, whatever, like something along those lines. Whereas now we're getting more modern times. I could see the demographic shifting in, just in that sense, in this, the what fits that archetype, colloquially speaking, may have shifted. But there also is the case of, well, now is this an MO that has gone wild and other people have latched onto it? And that's part of why the demographic has changed. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
No, I completely agree. And I think that that's why you are seeing more and more cases over time in more areas. Like we're getting, we just had a recent case in Nashville where there was never a case there ever, as far as I can remember. We've had the spate of killings in Lady Bird Lake. I believe that's Houston or Texas or something along those lines. So the cases are exploding. And that's partially why this is phenomenon is so interesting, is a lot of phenomenons involving crime that are the most interesting ones are cold, right? These are the cold ones are the ones that really get people interested and like get them to sink their teeth. Whereas this one's like a combination, a hybrid of, you have the cold clusters that occurred in certain areas, geographic areas, and then you have the new cases, which not only in a bubble are very interesting, but also are interesting because and relevant because they connect to older cases in terms of fact pattern and geography, right? So there's just, for instance, there's been a bunch of new cases, or there's been new cases on Michigan State University, and there was a huge cluster there back in the day. There's been new cases downtown Chicago. There was a huge cluster there back in the day. There's been new cases in Minneapolis, which is a very hot spot right now, currently. If there is killers, there's definitely a cell right now in Minneapolis. Just from like, you know, the frequency of the caseloads and certain cases, which are just absurdly suspicious. So it's that actually plays into how interesting the phenomenon is, the fact that it's like a hybrid of cold cases plus newer cases and how those two interplay with each other.
Yeah, and I find that interesting as well. I think as we brought up earlier with the smiley face, of just the vernacular of what we use to describe this, I think that kind of plays into this idea that we're kind of riffing on right now, too, of like how has the MO changed? Because I think there is a distinct possibility that as this MO has become more well known, its purposes very well may have shifted to other actors other than the initial ones, or along the point some other groups, you know, jumped along. So say, for example, those smiley face associations could have been some group of some sort that was using smiley faces for some reason, and then at some point, either they were the original ones or they weren't, and they adopted the smiley face later, then it got dropped, or what have you. Do you have thoughts on that, and just specifically in regards to the smiley faces? Because it sounds to me that it did just those smiley faces insignia showing up around the desk seem to just peter off at a certain point. I don't know if you, I know this is very speculative, but everything in the smiley face killings to a large degree kind of is speculative, unless we're just going to point out.
You're very true. You're very true. A lot of it is speculative, and a lot of it is balance of probabilities, right?
Yes.
I will say to what you were saying that the zeitgeist has grown quite a bit over the years. In terms of there's a very common, pattern that happens after these cases. So the kid is found in water. There's rampant media speculation. If you want a good example of this, you go to the Riley Strain case, which is a current case that's happening in Nashville right now. Insane media speculation. Jim Smith, who's another researcher who I speak with often, went viral on that case recently. The zeitgeist is growing like crazy. And the media drives it, because what happens is you have the media speaking on the fact that these are suspicious. Are there serial killers targeting X, Y, and Z? You had that exact same pattern in every single cluster, right down in Wisconsin, Minneapolis, Chicago, Michigan. In every case, the media speculated whether or not there's a serial killer. And that drove the zeitgeist and made people understand, hey, even if there wasn't necessarily a serial killer in these cases, this is an MO that works. And for 25 years, you had the media driving this, basically saying, hey, nobody knows what's going on here. These are very suspicious cases. And essentially, they're just dropping cues to people who are nefarious that, you know, hey, look, this might actually be a pretty good way to utilize the MO or to achieve my goals. And it's a cookie cutter MO. I think I said that to you, right? You could put any number of motives into the MO and it would, you know, work from that perspective, whether or not it's a sexual motive, whether or not you want to obtain the kit for sexual purposes, whether or not it's snuff, whether or not it's some type of religious execution, right? All of that fits perfectly into this, all of these motives, even more. Any motive you can really speculate would probably fit into this MO.
Yeah, I agree. I do think there's a lot to be digested here. I mean, I think we were talking a little bit before, and it does seem to be perfectly tailored to whether, I mean, obviously it's insanely speculative, but everything is, it's some sort of initiation to something else. I mean, obviously this could be something that would be used for perverse, you know, to be able to get away with the perfect crime, essentially. But it is, I just feel like how many people are really just going to be doing this for, you know, just for kicks. I have a bleak outlook somewhat on human condition, but that's a little bit stark that it would go to that extent. I have to believe there is some sort of group or groups that are acting here. I think that's where a lot of people go immediately. I know this show itself kind of, this episode itself spurned off of my coverage of 09A, 764 stuff. And there is some lore there. I guess what I'm kind of getting at is, what are your thoughts on those type of theories about groups implementing this? Obviously I'm not saying it's necessarily any one specific group, as I kind of alluded to a minute ago. It could be groups, and it also could be private actors as well that just want to, you know, carry out their, you know, fucked up fantasies, you know, and get away with it.
It's hard to speculate on the groups currently that are using the MO, because who knows the amount of copycats and people who have caught on. I mean, the line between a copycat and somebody who is actually, a SFK killer, right? If I would, is very, there's no hard line, right? So yeah. you have no idea.
A copycat is an SFK.
In essence, yeah. But we don't know how many people have, as I said, heard or seen on the media about these cases and decided to, you know, implement their motive onto the MO. I do know that, you know, there are indications in terms of how the killers are operating, right, in a very decentralized manner, decentralized cell structure. Different states have different cells, from my perspective. Your viewers can take that for what it's worth. I mean, clearly the leaderless resistance, decentralized cell structure is a very common concept. And I'm sure a lot of your viewers like instantly, you know, understand where that's coming from.
Yeah, for sure. I guess, well, let's get into why specifically is this MO so golden? I don't remember to what extent we covered earlier the exact MO, but I guess I just want to drive at why this kind of is, in a sense, the perfect MO. And I feel kind of fucked up saying that, because in a certain sense, you almost feel like you're driving people towards the MO. But I think we'll probably follow this up with like, well, then how do we go about fixing this? Maybe you have a bleak outlook on that. But I guess let's kind of like just go into like the specifics of the MO and just kind of what makes this the perfect MO, which, I mean, not that it necessarily needs to be spelled out for people, but I guess we can do it a little bit for them here if they haven't caught on to that exactly.
Sure. I mean, I have a good way of kind of illustrating that. I don't know if your viewers or you yourself have heard of the case of the serial killer Herb Baumeister before.
Sounds familiar, but I couldn't place it off top.
You can throw up his Wikipedia page if you want to follow along. It's a very interesting case as it relates to the Smiley Face Killers and why the motive or why the MO for the Smiley Face Killer is so successful, which is exactly kind of your question. So Herb Baumeister was a serial killer in Indianapolis. Basically, he would pick up his victims from bars, bring them back to his home, kill them, and bury them on his property. He got away with, I'm looking here, I don't know his kill count. I think over 10, a dozen, over a dozen, so over 12 cases before the police even knew that anyone was being killed. How did he get away with it? How did 12 people die before anyone knew that anything? Well, the answer to that question is that the perceived lifestyles of the victims made it so the police precluded it from being foul play. So the victims were gay. Herb Baumeister's victims were gay. The police distinctly did not investigate the cases as homicides because gays were perceived by the police to live transient lifestyles and come and go. He killed 12 people, and the only reason he got caught was because one of his victims escaped and ran to the police. Who knows, under that false assumption that gays are transient and are just, you know, come and go, how many more people he would have killed? So you take that story and you apply it to the smiley face killers. What happens in this case? Well, there's no prima facie evidence of an accident whatsoever. No evidence how or why the victim entered the water. They just vanish and they're in the water. You understand?
Yeah. Now, on the fact that they just vanish, this comes to the point of like, well, how do they just, this is, I feel like, a common point of like, how has no one ever really got busted for this? I think there's a couple cases that people allude, maybe this may have been alluding or be tied into, but seems to be, we don't really have anyone actually getting busted for this. So then I guess the question becomes,
there is no crime. That's why, at the end of the day, the cases are the same as the Baumeister cases where the police, there's no evidence why or how they entered the water, but they were seen engaging in nightlife and some have alcohol in their system. And as such, it's very convenient to assume, just like it was very convenient to assume in the Baumeister case that gays are transient, that the reason why they fell in the water is because of alcohol. Even though in not a single fucking case, my friend, is there a single shred of evidence, at least in my case list, and I have 80 cases in my list, a single shred of evidence why or how the victim entered the water. No CCTV footage, no witnesses hearing screaming, no objects strewn on the embankment and evidence of him falling down the embankment, nothing. They just vanish and they end up in water, or in the small subset of 15% cases, they just vanish completely and are never seen again.
Yeah, you mentioned exactly what I was driving at with that CCTV point. And the point is, it's part and parcel to the methodology here, where somehow, whether these people are getting some sort of inside information, whether they're very tech savvy, whatever it may be, these people are somehow evading being noticed in any way, shape, or form. Obviously, the MO alone, just the drowning, you know, getting, you know, targeting someone in a very vulnerable state, you know, or maybe even possibly drugging them and putting them into a vulnerable state. But on top of all that, now it seems to be whenever people do look into it, like you said, there's no CCTV footage, there's nothing. So I just kind of like, what are your thoughts? Is there something to that in that these people have some sort of knowledge on how to cover their tracks, even more so than just picking a smart MO?
They definitely do. I mean, to me, it's a probability thing, if you want to understand it from my perspective. So let's say we have 100 cases, okay? And in those 100 cases, there's no evidence whatsoever as to why or how the victim entered the water. But there's also no evidence of a crime, no evidence of an abduction, no evidence of nothing in terms of CCTV footage. How likely is it in that 100 case subset, is it that there was never one witness, CCTV footage, or evidence whatsoever as to how the victim entered the water? What is the likelihood that all 100 of those cases are accidents? You understand what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. From my perspective, the evidentiary burden is in the middle. It doesn't lean either direction, which means the subset of cases, the 100 cases, are likely to be mixed accident and homicides. Mm-hmm. There is no chance that one will be higher than one will be 98 to 2 or something. There would be no chance because the evidentiary burden is right in the middle. There's no evidence in either direction, which means it's likely to have a mixed subset or a mixed distribution in the cases.
Yeah.
And let me ask you, what's more likely? Mm-hmm. Is it more likely that means that there's, if in all 100 cases, there's no evidence as to how or why the victim entered the water, where the accident happened, why the accident happened, how likely is that? Sure, you can tell me, oh, the killers would have made a mistake. They would have been caught on camera. Well, I will counter argue that, well, wouldn't have the accident been caught on camera? Wouldn't there have been a witness somewhere? Wouldn't there have been physical evidence of an accident somewhere? isn't the fact that there is none of that more indicative of human intervention, right? You understand what I'm getting at? Is it almost proves, because there's so little evidence, that there has to be human intervention, because otherwise there would be a way more balanced probability of evidence, way more balanced evidence in terms of which side the case is more likely lean towards. But really, the balance of evidence is right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And you should also be concerned about that, because society and the public has already resigned themselves. They've already beta tested, as Jack Murphy would say, this theory in the public eye, right? They've already discluded it, right? That's what people would tell you. I mean, I would say that it's very, very likely that they're doing a shadow investigation. Mm. There's very, very unlikely that they're not investigating behind the scenes. And you know, these type of investigations, they would never reveal anything to the public. Yeah. It would affect the investigation, right? I mean, it would make it so they couldn't actually catch the killers, or make it so the killers would know that they're coming for them. So,
yeah, good point. Now, I guess the question I think all of this leads to is what's the move here for people like me and you? I feel like this kind of puts us in this weird catch-22, whereas are we doing more harm to the world by even bringing this up, in the sense that what this seems to be, there's some sort of perfect MO where people are able to do this. By bringing light to this, are we doing more harm than good? And if not, what is the move here? What do you think will crack it? Or do you think it's just an awareness thing, to where people start getting, hey, this is the MO, watch for this, you know, maybe stop having this reflexive, oh, I guess it was a suicide, he must have fell in the water. I guess just kind of, what are your thoughts generally there? Where do we go from here with this?
I'll tell you one thing, there is no clear end game. I'm interested in this personally, just from like a scholarly and anthropological perspective. But I don't actually believe that society, I believe it's going to take a lot for society to finally admit that the social contract is broken and that their society isn't as safe as they believe it to be. I mean, think about how hard of a understanding that's going to have to be for the public. And it's partially why I believe they would protect the public from the truth, because it would completely destroy the social contract to know that these cases have been going on for 20 years under the nose of law enforcement. There would need to be a large mistake in terms of the killers caught on camera with gear like infrared gear and tasers, you know, abducting someone, which is how I believe they do it. For the record, they would have to be caught on camera, and the public would actually have to physically see it for themselves. For this, and it's kind of sad to think about that, the public would have to, you know, be basically slapped in the face for them to believe this. But the truth is most of the public has not engaged with the entirety of the caseload. I don't actually believe I've met one single person who is engaged with the entirety of the caseload and in the end comes to the conclusion that they are all accidents. In fact, it's the opposite. Everyone who engages case by case comes to the opposite conclusion, that there is nefarious action going on here.
Yeah, and I guess to kind of my earlier point with, like, if we're doing it, I would take the position that I'm very much the same as you, that I just kind of follow my interests, and, you know, people who follow the show know that. And, you know, I don't know. I don't really, I guess, think too deeply about the consequences. But I would say I would say here that I actually think it's, you know, yeah, I know people's faith may be broken, the social contract. But personally, I think that's a good thing. You know, anyone's followed my political content would know why.
Not for the government, though, right? So no, we're talking about the people who are conducting the investigation. Yep. What do they believe the public should know? And what is it? What does it affect? How does it affect, you know, what their job is, which is to protect national security and ensure Absolutely. That, you know, yeah. So just to point out there, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. You're right. And, you know, that's exactly the issue here. And that's why I think it's like researchers like you, or just other voices just talking about this, getting this to where it enters the zeitgeist, is what can really make a difference. And yeah, we may never like actually bust someone, but I think the real fucked up part about this is, like, I don't know. I can see it from my lens. I'm kind of, I guess to some extent, I sort of at one point fit that archetype. And in a lot of ways, I still sort of do of the ones that get targeted. I mean, I'm older now, a family man, but it's just the idea of like a young man being targeted while vulnerable. And I think so many young men don't have that in their head. And I know I didn't. And if just that can just be something in the back of your head of like, you know, be more careful with these sorts of things, whether it be out drinking, watch your drinks, whatever. Because I just feel like that's not something men do, like, at all. Like, because what, like, what, someone's going to rape me? Like, maybe if I was, like, hanging out in a gay bar or something, maybe. But, like, you know, just a normal bar. And I, well, to be clear, that's not disparaging against gays or something. But, like, you know, generally as a dude in, you know, mixed gender environments, you're not the target. Like, you're just not. Like, so it is this twisted thing for men to try to comprehend that they might be the target. Women, I think, you know, to some extent, maybe they're a little bit more silly with it when they're younger, but they're taught from a young age that, like, be careful, you know.
Never leave a bar at 3 a.m. alone and start walking home, which is what we see here. There's no female cases because females would never, ever do that. It's only males who believe that they're not targets, as you said. And it's only males with kind of like Sorry, you can continue.
Yeah, and I think, I just think it's just a sense of machismo in men. I don't think about it. And then there is something to this dichotomy we spoke of with the state and then the individual and the idea that, well, the state will take care of you. And I know young men aren't really putting this in their head like, well, the state will take care of me. They're just young and dumb and full of cum and just like I'm invincible against the world. But like there is also to some extent in, you know, a lot of people, this idea that the state will protect you. And I think the individual needs to take their own protection a little bit more in mind, especially young men is in light of this. I know hearing this story, I was like, I don't have any sons, but if I did, this would be something I'd be like, you need to be careful. Cause I know I easily many times in my youth could have been this victim. Cause you're just dumb. You're just going to bars or hanging out with the boys, getting messed up and you're, you know, blacking out, whatever, like just not at all any regards for your safety. Because, you know, if you are like some 200-pound man and in good physical shape, it's like, what's someone going to do? Like, maybe I find another guy that's slightly bigger than me and I get a little bit beat up. Like, nothing's really going to happen to me. No one's going to target me because they know, like, the same idea that you wouldn't go try to fight a gorilla. You know it's not going to end well. Like, so I guess I'm just kind of rambling there. I find it distinctly pretty fucked up, but I do think it's an important pill that people need to swallow to take their own personal safety a little bit more in mind, even if you don't think you're the target, because you could be. The very fact that you think you won't be a target might make you a target. I'm just a little bit rambling here. I don't know if you have any thoughts to extrapolate on that.
I mean, it hits home when you say that you can see yourself as being the victim, because that's how I perceive myself as well, like as, you know, somebody who could have been in that scenario. And here's the key to these cases and the kind of crux on why the MO is so perfect is that at the end of the day, there is not a single time in a young man's life, not a single one, where he is more vulnerable than when he is leaving a bar alone, drunk, at 3 a.m. in the night. You cannot find it. It will not happen. Like, it might happen with some people, but for these good college-age kids, they are never in situations worse than that. That is the pinnacle of when they are vulnerable.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you can be the biggest, you can be the top, you could be the football star in college and you're still if you're blackout drunk or been roofied or whatever, it's game over, lights out. Some 120-pound effeminate dude could take you down no problem at that point. You're done. So that's what makes this distinctly evil. I did want to, for the purposes of this episode, I did want to kind of make this an intro. So let me know if there's any other specific things in kind of an introductory fashion. Me and you're going to talk more after, and I think you'll probably send me more info. We might do further addendums to this, but I just really wanted to wet my audience's, wet their tongue. What was even the expression there? I don't know. Wet their mouth. I forget what the hell it is, but
beak, either beak, way, I believe.
Wet their beaker. Yeah, that's right.
No, beak as in a bird.
Beak. There you go. That's right. That's the expression. So I wanted to get them kind of an introductory thing here. Is there anything specifically kind of in the vein of introductory, you know, things to know about this that you feel like my audience should know before we wrap this up?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we talked about certain variations of the cases. Not every case is similar. We talked about the fact that a lot of the cases fall under a specific demographic, but not every case, right? So there are variations. It's not, these variations aren't hard rules. They're kind of just how the cases have kind of bled out. Another variation that people have noticed as a pattern amongst clusters is the fact that these cases tend to happen on colder weather days and drinking holidays. So, or just holidays in general where people will be out, more likely to be out at nightlife. So we're talking about Halloween. These are the times where it's, you know, super potent is Halloween, New Year's, and March break. All three typically the colder drinking holiday months.
Yeah, prime time for targets, yeah.
Correct. And if you're using this theory where you're targeting people in red light districts by using blackout zones, right? You're finding a predetermined blackout zone where there's no cameras. You know that it's a drinking holiday. So you know that at 3 a.m. eventually, you know, probability wise, there will be someone who enters the blackout zone. The cold weather is very important for that, right? So you have to ensure that not only there's no cameras, but there's no people. How do you do that, right? It has to be in real time. You either have to have some type of infrared night vision where you're looking around, or it has to be in really cold and really late times, because that's when there's very little foot traffic, very little people to witness. And that's what we see, a very common thing. Like these cases, for some reason, people don't, drink in the summer, apparently. with these cases, people don't succumb to accidents in the summer. For some reason, really fat kids don't succumb to these drinking accidents, nor do really tall or bulky kids, right? It's typically, you know, very slim demographics, very, you know, typical type, very cookie cutter type of person. That's an interesting kind of variation of the cases, is the fact that not all of them happen in cold weather, but there are clusters where it's clear that the killers are using cold weather to their advantage it comes to abductions.
That makes sense. I don't think I'd heard that that component before, but that makes, as I'm thinking about that, makes a lot of sense. During the holidays, you know, during the drinking times, there's going to be more people in the bars, but on the inverse, there's going to be less people on the waterfront in colder times. So like you said,
less casual foot traffic, almost no casual foot traffic, yes, at that time. There's the only foot traffic will be nightlife foot traffic at that time.
And even then, that would be maybe a few people stumbling home from the bar, taking a shortcut, whatever. I mean, who the hell is going to go?
Perfect targets. And that's all I'm trying to say to your viewers, is that there are cases upon cases upon cases where people are just walking home from bars, the same type of individual, and just vanish. And it's not just ending up in water. A lot of these kids vanish and are never seen again. And nobody has been able to grapple with that, the fact that not every case involves somebody falling in water. Nobody has been able to explain what happens to these kids who just go missing. Bryce Borka is a great case. In Minneapolis, a recent case where the kid is just missing. He just hasn't been found. And nobody bloody knows. And a super hot spot where he went missing, like in the Minneapolis area, there's just insane amounts of cases. So nobody can explain that. People try and explain the drowning cases as, you know, oh, he likely just fell in. He was drunk. He was just an idiot. For some reason, he got to the water and he was a vegetable and just fell in and couldn't pull himself out. But they can't explain the missing cases, because they just, there's no way for them to cope. There's no way for them to just grapple with it.
Which I guess this would be a good time to mention, to kind of tie these two together. Correct me if I'm wrong, but usually one common through line of this MO is someone disappears, then reappears later in a body of water. There usually is, it's... So I think a lot of people, if we didn't say that, may think that what is happening here is someone has a bad night or whatever, and then the next day we find them in the water. But it seems to be what is really happening in a lot of cases. Like I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but usually someone has a quote-unquote bad night, and then days later, sometimes weeks later, I believe.
Sometimes months later. You're right. There is a period of time, and people have speculated the victims are held prior to being dumped. That's a very common speculation. So you're, I mean, you definitely know, you definitely have some good insight in terms of what's going on. There's no doubt about that.
I just want to bring that for the audience so they can make the connection between that and the missing persons. Cause otherwise you would seem, sounds like you're just, you know, mushing together disparate MOs. So that way the audience can understand why the connection, cause it's kind of like, why did some of them not make it to the water? That is a curious point. Like, what happened here? Obviously something's being done in the interim to these people. It could be all sorts of different things for different people. But obviously it sounds like, you know, if we're going to lump some of these missing persons in with it, then it's like, well, where did some of them not end up in the place for some reason or another? I mean, who knows? Maybe something happened. The body got too damaged in the process. We're like, well, we can't sell this as a simple drowning. I don't know. I'm sure there's sometimes it doesn't always go exactly as planned.
That's why I said the hallmark is the missing part, right? Where they're engaged in nightlife and they go missing. What happens after then is, you know, there are certain variations, and it's not to say that the drowning cases don't have evidence of foul play, because there actually is certain analysis that does point to the drownings being foul play. Some of the analysis involves the victims being found in areas of water that were previously searched. That's a common thread. A common thread is that, you know, the currents wouldn't have brought the victim this far. And another common thread, which I just spoke with Murphy about, and this is actually one of the more interesting ones as it relates to the drowning cases, it actually blows the entire drowning accident theory out of the water, is the distance and terrain traveled by some of these victims is inconsistent with the theory that they were overly drunk or inebriated, and that's what resulted in them succumbing to an accident. You understand what I'm saying when I say that?
Yeah, like they went too far away to where it would make sense that they were
correct,
drunk.
Or just traversed certain terrain like fences or trees, and you know, like certain stuff where you don't think that somebody who was that drunk who became a vegetable when they hit the water would have been able to do that.
Yeah, it's the same idea. For those who follow my channel, know Terrence Yeake. The theory, the official narrative, is that he, you know, started, you know, doing self harm inside of his car, which was covered in blood. You know, estimated around 2 liters. He was, I believe, sickle cell anemic, so he wouldn't operate well under intense blood loss, and he somehow, his body ended up a half mile on the low estimate, I believe a mile and a half on some of the higher estimates, away through rough terrain with a bullet in his head, supposedly self-imposed, yet at a weird angle with gunshot residue showing that it clearly wasn't point blank. So obviously the point being is, like, you know, it wouldn't make sense. You know, the point I'm making here is it wouldn't make sense for him to somehow end up from that car to the field that he ended up in. How the fuck did that happen with the intense amount of blood loss and this guy having sickle cell anemia? He would have had to have been crawling and probably would have made it maybe a tenth of a mile, if that. So similar idea is what I'm assuming you're getting at.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways if you're somebody who wants to dispute these drownings as just accidents. You cannot have it both ways, and you need to understand that, because if you're assessing these cases as somebody who was too drunk and, you know, was at the water and said, you know, and was just unable to control themselves, fell in, was so drunk they couldn't pull themselves out, if that's your analysis, then you can't have it where they're walking or getting to that location before actually being incapacitated. It's incongruent. It doesn't make sense. And as you said, it's kind of like a gap in the logic where people, like, you know, they almost want to feel safe, right? They want to feel that the police are doing their job, that there are no threats to them. And they have tunnel vision, it seems like, you know, the public, they overlook these certain aspects that, you know, it just doesn't make sense where this person is a vegetable once they hit the water and once they get to the water. But before that, there's just this sentient person. And I want to say one thing. A lot of cases, the victim is seen prior to disappearing completely sentient on CCTV. Nobody has been able to grapple with that fact, because people who see those cases, they cannot say that the person was too drunk and thus fell in the water. There has to be another explanation. As such, also cases where kids are found with a low blood alcohol content, which completely, you know, makes it impossible for anyone to rationalize why they would have been so drunk that they fell in the water.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would make the case there with this MO. Any hallmark of a good system has redundancies in place. That way, if one of the many steps fails, another one will take its place. As you mentioned, like as soon as you said that there are people who are lucid or sentient or whatever, it made me think that maybe there are cases in which the whatever, whether it be drugging or them being, or maybe they misjudged how fucked up they were or whatever, that may not, their plan may be foiled at that level in some cases. And then comes into play, as you mentioned earlier, your theory, or maybe not necessarily your theory, I'm sure there maybe it was other researchers, I'm not sure, when it comes to maybe something being used like a taser or something along those lines.
Because that is my personal theory. And yes. I believe that's the only reason why I believe that is because I believe it's the only way to replicate the MO the way they've been doing it successfully, because mm-hmm. they've been replicating it like a cookie cutter, and they've been very successful at it. There's actually no way, in my opinion, to not leave defensive wounds on these kids and abduct them without being very specific in the type of tools you're using. In my opinion, there would be defensive wounds on the kids. They'd be fighting back. It would be obvious that they were accosted. And none of that that's why there's no, these victims who end up in water and that are found, they have no signs of a crime, no signs of being attacked or anything. And there's very few ways you can do that reliably. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm getting at?
No, and as I was pointing out, I think it has a secondary function in that it essentially operates as a redundancy in, you know, getting your target. Because, yes, you could just have some guy who's inebriated or drugged or whatever, and you could either manipulate him or overpower him very easily. But, you know, in these situations where maybe that fails or they, for whatever reason, don't resort to that, now you have a taser and it's late at night and it is someone that's coming back from a bar. I mean, even if you aren't drunk, you're still tired. You're still kind of not really paying attention, not really in the moment. It's not that hard to kind of take someone by surprise and hit them with a taser and game over. You will get knocked out depending on the strength of the taser.
It's the perfect tool for abduction. I mean, I'm saying that as a private researcher, not as someone who's telling you to go and abduct someone with a taser, but it is literally like the God tool. If anyone has never Googled or YouTubed taser, police taser, you can see what happens when somebody gets tasered. They go down like a ton of bricks. And the interesting thing about tasers is there's no discernible wounds on the body, especially as time goes on. It appears more and more like a bruise. And I don't know if you've ever seen a body come out of water. Probably not. I hope not.
No.
It's been bitten by fish. It's been hit by rocks. It has bruises all over it. Finding or deciphering that, you know, a small bruise on the body, one small bruise of a trillion small bruises on a body that gets pulled out of water was a electroshock weapon is almost impossible.
Yeah, super inconsistent. That's the nature of electricity. Like I know when I was people who follow the show know I was active duty military as an aircraft mechanic for over 11 years. And when we had lightning strike a jet, you would have to find the essentially where the electricity entered and where it exited. And that could literally be at any point in the plane. It was one of the worst inspections ever because that means you had to essentially shut down all operations. And it was not necessarily all hands on deck, but a lot of hands on deck to literally look over the entire fucking aircraft for a tiny, tiny little pinpoint like this of what is the result of a lightning strike. And the reasoning why it needs to do such an inspection is to essentially for forensic reasons, so you can see if any, you know, components have been damaged, what direction did this thing likely take, whatever. You know, make sure you're not setting that thing up for a flight when, you know, it has some components you weren't aware of really fucked up and that could cause some problems. And now imagine this with a taser on the human body. Like you said, it might leave maybe like a minor burn, a bruise, but even then it's going to be incredibly, I would assume, I'm no forensic pathologist, but I would assume it's going to be incredibly inconsistent, the bruise it makes. Well, even if there was consistent within the same type of taser, there are different levels of tasers. It would just be so inconsistent. It's not the same as like a gunshot wound or something. You're not going to be able to, after the fact, be like, well, this is a fucking Stanley, you know, version 3.4 or whatever.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because you seem to have actually inside knowledge of this, because I've just read scholarly articles. I've never actually seen a taser wound in my life. But what the scholarly articles say is that the wounds are not distinct. right? The wounds are not something where you look at it and you're like, oh, that's a taser wound, right? That's definitely a taser wound. It looks like a bruise. And especially as time goes on, it develops more and more into a bruise. There isn't exactly one distinctive thing where a medical examiner looking at the body is going to say, especially when it's covered in bruises everywhere, right? And it's very difficult to discern or to figure out which bruise you're looking at, right? But the medical examiner wouldn't be able to decipher. And that's why there's no signs of a struggle on the body, why they're able to, you know, abduct so efficiently.
Yeah.
And I'd like your insight on that, actually, because
I want to be very clear. I'm coming from no expert opinion. This is just me being a knuckle dragger, working in maintenance, and also getting electrocuted a handful of times when I was in construction when I was in high school. I mean, so yeah, like a little, but it's just kind of like an inference from the nature of electricity, how I've seen lightning strikes affect airplanes, how I've seen a handful of like electrical shocks affect people. It doesn't, I mean, shit, I've been zapped to where like I lost consciousness for a moment and leaves no discernible trace whatsoever. That's just the nature of electricity. It runs through your entire body, it dissipates. You maybe might have something at like the entrance and the exit, and that's about it, you know, if that.
So. Yeah, the MO, that from that perspective, as I perceive the killers, my UNSA profile, it's very, the killers have to be knowledgeable about militaristic or, you know, paramilitaristic strategies and clandestine operations. That's who these killers are, in my opinion. And that's, in my opinion, any unsub you're going to fill the profile with, especially with the earlier cases, has to have that type of knowledge to be able to operate clandestinely without detection, using tools that are, you know, known for not for being able to achieve, you know, essentially black ops tools for black operations, for you know, quiet soft target abductions. That's what these are, right? At the boiled down to the purest, that's what these cases are.
Yeah, which makes it interesting that this has spread in the way it has, because we have kind of sort of posited the idea that maybe it's a runaway MO, but then in the same breath, it is weird that still there haven't been anyone who slipped up. And you would think, you know, obviously you've kind of covered, you know, different theories, but if you're just some dude on the street or whatever hearing about the Smiley Face killings and are like, oh, well, this is a perfect MO, like, you may not know all these details. So it does make you think that maybe there's some barrier to entry here in some sort, in the sense that the people that would carry out this may be a little bit more established or cell grouped or whatever than just some sort of, you know, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just kind of random, you know, out of nowhere. Like, I just feel like doing some people in type people. You know what I mean? Do you have any thoughts on that specific?
I would say there's different tiers. Some variations of the MO are very polished. And what I'm talking about with these type of tools, like night vision and electroshock weapons, is a very polished version of the MO. What you were referring to earlier are more brute force, like you know, brute type elements of the MO, where the victim is maybe just, you know, accosted and thrown in a van, or punched in the face, or knocked out, or put in a van at gunpoint, or drugged. These are more like rudimentary, more less polished versions of the MO. And we have cases of both, right? So a case of a less polished version of the case is a famous case, Patrick McNeil, where there's witnesses who saw two people in a car following him as he was stumbling away from the bar, drunk as shit. He ends up in the water a couple week or whatever, however longer later. He was one of the most famous cases. But that was a very, very rudimentary version of the MO, where somebody just, you know, rolls up on you as you're leaving the bar and stuffs you in a car, or, you know, abducts you like that. What I'm discussing is potentially, you know, potentially what I believe is the unsubs that were behind the beginning of the cases, because even if the cases exploded, they began somewhere. They had to have begun somewhere. There was a point where the clusters began. And that's my personal interest, is the origin of the cases before they kind of like permeated into the zeitgeist, or the, you know, the mythos of society, before anyone really knew about the cases, who was doing this and why.
Yeah. Well, maybe as we get further along in this MO catching fire, as it seems to be, maybe we'll get to a point where it'll get more and more sloppy, as it sounds to be. It was seems to be more polished in the past, and maybe there are still actors out there that are, you know, polished, but it's getting maybe getting a little bit out of hand, and more outside actors are jumping in and getting on the action, and maybe there will be some slip-up. Obviously, if that's the slip-up, this might not be one that's connected to some other group, but at the very least, maybe people will start getting a grasp on this is an MO that is being used, and hopefully maybe we can kind of get to a place like that in the future. But I think with that, we've kind of covered a lot of the good introductory information. We may cover this later in the future. I'm completely open to that. You know, with the way my show works, I do like to do playlists, like to do full series, like to really dig into it. So I'm completely open to that. But with that, Igor, is there anywhere that you want to direct my audience to? Is there anywhere they can find your research? Maybe, and if or are there places that you would direct them to learn more about this?
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to go far to find cases that are applicable. I've given you kind of the parameters. They're everywhere, and there's researchers everywhere. I have a Twitter account. I post cases. There's another researcher, Jim Smith, at Smiley Face Cult on Twitter. He posts cases. He's way more into the scene than I am. People can also message me on Twitter if they have interest on certain clusters. I mean, you said you like to dig into stuff. I would suggest that if you want to do specific episodes on specific clusters, it really is interesting how certain states have certain clusters. In each state, you can analyze them within a bubble, right, in terms of the clusters in their states. And if anyone wants info on a particular state, there's been clusters in Minnesota. These are the main clusters I'm talking about: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Chicago, or Illinois, and Michigan. So basically Midwest clusters, Boston, another big area, New York. All of these hot places have clusters, and I have no problem, anyone who messages me, sharing the case names and where to find details of the cases from clusters from those areas. But I mean, people who have a Google, have a computer can figure this out themselves as well. They just Google drowning or missing bar student X state, and you'll get everything. Because that's, as I said, that's the hallmark of the case: missing from a bar or missing from some type of party or venue or nightlife establishment. Very few people are necessarily posting cases, but Jim Smith is a good one to follow. Jim Smith at Smiley Face Cult. He's like very active in posting cases.
Well, you propose a good idea there. Maybe that's what could be what we can do in the future. Focus on clusters, maybe starting from the beginning, working up, or whatever way maybe you think's the most cohesive way to break this down. But I like that idea. It's a good idea, kind of break it down by clusters. But with that, for those who like the show, you can follow us on YouTube, all the major Arbitrators, Rumble as well. Make sure you give us a like, share, subscribe, boost us up in the algos, all that good nonsense. And with that, we are out.